If you have trouble with the alphabet, try Glyphs on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we'll explore Brian Alm's interest in all things Egyptian, then examine the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor on Scribble.
Brian, I've known you for a long time, ever since you were a student at Augustana College and followed your career through the Navy and the Kankakee Journal and John Deere, but I had no idea until about 10 years ago that you were really a secret Egyptologist. How did that happen?
Well, it goes back a long way, back to when I was about 12 years old, and my parents took me to the Field Museum in Chicago, and I saw the mummies, and I was fascinated by them. And over the years, I would, you know, read a little bit here and there. I didn't realize back in those days that you could actually make a living at it. And in fact, most people who go into it don't now. So I went other directions. But I was always spellbound by the Egyptian stuff. And I would read at it from time to time. And eventually, when I was working at other things, I didn't have the time to really bore into it at a scholarly level. But once I retired, and I retired early, and once I retired, I could devote full time to it. So I've been at it for a number of years now, pretty much full time Egyptology.
But aside from the mummies, which I guess every kid gets fascinated with, why not a culture like Greece and Rome?
Way too recent. You know, by the time, by 1000 BC, which was well before anything going on in Greece and Rome, Egypt was already in deep decline.
Yeah, that was an old, old empire. Went way back. We're trying to figure out how all this trouble started, you know, how humans got organized. To the extent that they ever are organized. They look at Sumer and places like that, but Egypt was a very fertile ground for development of society. But how exactly it happened, who knows? We can't figure that out.
Well, there's been a lot of study of that, and there are people who specialize in pre-dynastic. It goes back a little bit harder, a little harder for me to follow going back that far. It's there just isn't as much to deal with.
Mm-hmm. How far back do hieroglyphics go, and how did they even originate in the first place? Does anyone know?
Oh yeah, they probably started around 3250 BC, and
that's pretty specific.
Yeah. Some will say more like 3150, or some say 3300, but most people figure it's about 3250 BC. And they started off as just simply names, very simple names, and labels for like wine shipments. But then they developed, and by the time you get to, let's say 3000 BC, the language is really forming up pretty well. The language that we study primarily is the it's called Middle Egyptian, which was classical Egyptian. It began about 2100 BC and went through about 1300, and it is pretty much the standard. You know, High Egyptian, if you will. And the grammar that was developed during that time pretty much lasted all the way through the rest of dynastic history.
You know, the whole business of language, it's amazing how someone first thought to make a sign or a mark and have it stand for a word or a person. And then from that, to break it down into sounds and put all that together. Surely this was not the province of all the people, was it? I mean, was the use of hieroglyphs pretty much the priestly caste, the nobility, the scribes?
At most, only 1% of the people were ever literate. And so take a, you know, suppose they had 3 million people at late period, the Roman, the Greek and Roman period, they might be up to 5 million. But typically during the Middle and New Kingdom, they would have about 3 million people. So that's 1% of that would be, what, 30,000.
Well, that's a small number.
Yes, it is.
So was the written language different from the spoken language?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we don't know a whole lot about the spoken language. We know more than you might imagine. Nobody actually knows what it sounds like because there's no tape. You know, there's no recording of it. But you can dope out quite a bit just from comparison with some other Afro-Asiatic languages, and also certainly with modern Arabic. And you can puzzle out some from like rhymes that would occur in poetry. But primarily our clue to what the spoken language sounds like comes from the Coptic Christian Church, because Coptic was the sort of the final gasp of ancient Egyptian. It was the final iteration of that whole language. And the Coptic Church still uses it as a liturgical language. And as a liturgical language, everything had to be spoken exactly the same and exactly right. And they preserved it like that as a fossil language to this day.
Can you speak any at all? I mean, can we hear a sample of what it might have sounded like?
I wish. you know, I can say the words, but, you know, every Egyptologist will tell you, if I would say something to an ancient Egyptian, they wouldn't have a clue as what I was talking about. But if I wrote it down for them, they'd be fine.
Well, you know, writing it down. I've looked at hieroglyphs. I got a book once on hieroglyphs. I thought, why can't I just, you know, work this out, see what the alphabet is like? It becomes clear after a while that it's not just one symbol meaning one sound all the time. There are all kinds of complexities in hieroglyphs.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, there are essentially three kinds of glyphs. The first is the one you're talking about, and that's the phonemes, the phonetic value glyphs, phonograms. And of those, there are three kinds. And the first kind is called uniliteral, and it has just one consonant. And those can be used as alphabetic signs.
You say one consonant. How about vowels?
Well, they technically didn't use vowels. There are things in the language that look like vowels, but they're not technically vowels.
Like Hebrew, right?
Yes, very much like Hebrew. And Arabic. And as a matter of fact, Roald, you're asking about what does it sound like. The closest probably you could come now would be modern Arabic. But back to these phonograms, there are also two consonant or biliteral sounds and triliteral sounds. And so those all can be used to put together sounds and words. Now, let's take your name, Don. They would have they would use a biliteral for that. I can't think of the biliteral for DN, but that was what it would turn out to be, a DN.
So there'd be just one hieroglyph.
There would be one glyph, and it would not be either the D or the N. You could spell D, which looks like a mitten, and N, which looks like a zigzag line. You could put those together alphabetically, But no, the Egyptians wouldn't do it. They would have yet another glyph that would stand for DN. Now, with rolled, it would be a different story because, look at what they did with the Ptolemies. They didn't have an L in the Egyptian language. Consequently, when the Ptolemies showed up in 332 BC from Greece, they had to think of how to spell Ptolemy. So they borrowed a character, a glyph that looks like a couchant lion, and it was the glyph for Ru, R-U, and they used that for Ptolemy. So you can see a cartouche with one of the Ptolemies' names on it, and it will be alphabetic.
But you have to know when to make that switch from the R sound to the L sound.
Yes.
But how do we know that? Somewhere along the line, and I go back to my weekly reader, which determined my life essentially, to something called the Rosetta Stone. That plays a part here. I think everybody's heard that phrase, but most of us have no idea what it really is.
I got to see it in the British Museum.
All right.
Back when they had the real thing. Now they have a fake out there. But
so what part did that play in?
Big part. That was the key to getting into the study of hieroglyphs. The Rosetta Stone had three languages on it. There was Greek, which they, of course, could read, the Greeks, or anybody. And it also had hieroglyphs, which they could not read. And then it had Demotic, which was a late form of ancient Egyptian, done in a very cursive style, and it was used for business documents and fast writing and that kind of thing. The hieroglyphs, by the way, the classic hieroglyphs, the picture language that we see, the Egyptians called that Medu Netcher, which means the words of God. It was used primarily for religious purposes. Now, when they found this Rosetta Stone, they surmised that maybe all these three bodies of text said the same thing. They could read the Greek and figure that out. And then by comparing things here and there, they started piecing it all together. One of the first things that they did, aside from the Rosetta Stone, one of the first clues they had was the name Cleopatra. And they could find it was, and because she was a Ptolemaic king, and I say king, not queen, because she was a female king from the Greeks, they spelled her name alphabetically. So then, when they found Ptolemy, now they're really on a roll. They had the L, various letters that they could start piecing together using comparing from Demotic Greek and hieroglyphs and working it back and forth until they finally figured it out.
But there still are mysteries about this, aren't there? Can we be absolutely sure that every glyph we see gives us just the meaning that we ascribe to it?
No, absolutely not. Well, as I started to say earlier, we have three different kinds of glyphs. One is the alphabetic or the phonograms that give you sound. They're sound signs. Then there are the word signs, ideograms and logograms that tell you what they're signs for words. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third group called the determinatives, and they are particularly interesting. They're not ever pronounced. They're only written, and they give you a clue as to what the foregoing letters meant. For example, you could have the letters M, I, and U, which would be pronounced mu. And you may not still know what that is. Well, as a matter of fact, it's the word for cat, mew.
I like it.
But to make sure you know that it's the cat, there is a little picture of a cat following the three letters. So That's a determinative. Now, determinatives, there are a lot of them, and they're very handy things. For example, you could have a picture, you could have a little glyph that shows a pair of legs walking. And if you have a couple of other glyphs, a glyph a glyph that in some cases means house. If you have the little legs behind that glyph that means house, then it means go forth. But if you turn the legs around, it means go back, return. There are all kinds of little subtleties. For another one, there are various determinatives of a man standing. In one case, he's standing erect with a staff. And that is a glyph that indicates authority or management. He may be sitting down and holding his arms out in front of him. All that indicates is it's a man. But there also may be, let's say the man is standing, but he's bent over with a cane. It means that he's old or infirm. Or he may be raising a stick to strike, and that would indicate that he's a soldier or an overseer. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of subtleties that are conveyed by these unpronounced determinatives.
So, Brian, have you learned to read glyphs?
You know, I'm terrible at it. I can read basic stuff. I can certainly read the cartouches and, you know, put together, a sense of what's going on in there. But long-running text, I am just terrible at it. It is I'll tell you what. When I was in college, I had to have a language, and I thought, I'll take German because German is a very hard language, and I thought that would be fun. And it was. Later, many years later, I decided I would teach myself Russian. And I thought that was made German look like a piece of cake. Well, let me tell you what. Middle Egyptian will make Russian look like a piece of cake.
Did the language change? I mean, most languages sort of evolve and change. Even the symbol. I was just reading a Jane Hirschfield essay about the way in which the original letter A, if you put the letter A sideways, what you see, the capital A, are the two horns of an ox and the head of an ox. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, today it doesn't look like an A at all. I mean, an A doesn't look like an ox, but it did.
Uh-huh.
Were that kind of changes, or is this pretty hieroglyphics pretty consistent throughout the centuries?
The language was extremely consistent. The grammar was extremely consistent. The appearance of the language changed, though, because you have the classical hieroglyphs that everybody, you know, recognizes as hieroglyphs. But that was very, very difficult to do fast. And so they to write faster and to get more said. Let's say for you know, documents, legal documents or long stories or treaties or, you know, something that where you had to do a lot of writing, they went to a cursive form started up as far back as 3000 BC, as a matter of fact. But then that morphed into what was called hieratic, which was also a cursive form, still using the glyphs. Most of them I can recognize, but sometimes they're just such a brief symbolic stroke that I can't figure out what they're trying to say.
Well, apparently they had some kind of shorthand, too.
Well, it's essentially what it was. And then hieratic developed into demotic, and at that point, that was the end of any semblance of glyphs. Mm-hmm. When Coptic came along, they used the Greek alphabet. But there were eight characters in Coptic that they could not that they had to borrow from Egyptian.
Ryan, I can see how this could absorb you, and it can absorb us forever. But we're going to run out of time here.
No, what a shame.
But thank you very much. That is quite interesting. And now, dear listener, you may start your course in the study of hieroglyphs.
Well, you can come into come to Comm University. We can put you through a little of that there.
There we go.
That's this February, right?
Yes, February.
Okay, good.
And with that, we will turn to Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. You know, I really should have brought an old, old book I have on Om Seti.
Oh, yeah.
Have you read that book?
No, but I know I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, it's this woman who went to the British Museum and suddenly was convinced that she had lived in Egypt and she had a relationship with the pharaoh and so on. And later on, you know, they thought she was crazy. Later on, she went to Egypt. She married an Egyptian. I think she had one child. Then she stayed in Egypt and worked around these places, and archaeologists would come talk to her, and she'd say, well, right here there was a pool and so on. It's the most amazing thing.
And she wrote several books, right?
I don't know. I just read a book about her, about Om Seti.
Yeah, very strange.
Very strange. You know, it's not something, the sort of thing that I would find credible, and yet she astounded. She astounded some of those archaeologists with what appeared to be detailed recollection of where things were. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Yeah, but anyway, I can't think of the name of the book. It's an old paperback thing on Om Seti. One of the most amazing things I've ever read. You got a quick recommendation?
I got a quick recommendation. Let's stay on things Egyptian, and because knowing we were going to have Brian on, I went back to one of the great works, I think, of contemporary Egyptian literature by Naguib Mahfouz, M-A-F-O-U-Z, who wrote in the 1950s primarily, won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1988. But he's written a great book, if you want to understand contemporary Egyptian culture, called the Cairo Trilogy in the 1950s. The first book is The Palace Walk, the second, The Palace of Desire, and the third one, Sugar Street. It covers three generations of an upper-middle-class Egyptian family from World War I until the 1950s. And if you like old-fashioned family histories like John Galsworthy's The Forsyte Saga or Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, you'll love and get a great picture of contemporary Egypt in Mahfouz's novels.
You know, when they award the Nobel Prize to people who write in a language I can't read, I wonder how they did it. But what is the trilogy again?
The Cairo Trilogy, it's called, and it reads like a tapestry. I mean, it's dense, but it's hard to put down.
Very good. And the man's name is Mahfouz?
Mahfouz. Naguib, N-A-G-U-I-B, M-A-F-O-U-Z.
Okay. And I can spell R-O-A-L-D. Thanks, Roald. And
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. I'm Don Wooten. We'll be back next week for another edition of Scribble.